Good evening. Thanks for coming out. I was a little afraid that after taking a hiatus from Medrash over the summer, I'd come back and have an empty table, so I'm relieved that that's not the case. This is a two-part series. We'll see what happens after Sukkot, whether we'll start up again on a weekly basis. I know that Rabbi Karofkin plans to do his Judaism 101 series again after Sukkot, and I'm not interested in going up against that. So we'll see. We'll figure something out. But what I hope to do with this tonight, as well as next week, is to look at the story of the Akedah, the binding of Yitzchak, as it's literally translated, Avram's attempt to offer up his son as a karban to God, through the eyes of Medrash. Now, you could study that story forever. There are so many different aspects to it, so many different issues involved, and what we'll be looking at are just a couple of narrow slices, but with particular relevance for the run-up to Rosh Hashanah. It is, of course, the reading of the second day of Rosh Hashanah, and so that's one association, and then we take the image of the shofar in part from the ram's horn, because the ram is used in place of Yitzchak as an offering to God, so that's another element. We'll see other associations with our preparation for Rosh Hashanah. The medrash I've chosen for tonight is not what I would consider a groundbreaking medrash. But I believe it does provide important lessons. And it's building on the passage that I brought in source number one. This is from the beginning of the story of the Akedah. God is speaking to Abraham, and he says, Vayomer, and he said, Kach na es bincha. Take, please, or take now your son. And the word na there may be translated either way. Either he says take him now, or he says please take him, either way. And then he describes him, and I skip to the part where he describes his son, because it's not germane for us right now. V'ha'alehu sham le'ola al achad he'horim asher omar elecha. And God says to Abraham, bring him up there as in ola. Ola, I translated on the sheet as ascendant offering, something that goes up. La'alot is to go up. The truth of the matter is that that's cheating. Because Ola is not only to go up. Ola is a jargon word in the Torah. When you see the word Ola generally in the Torah, certainly in the context of giving a gift to God, it means a burnt offering. An offering which is put on the altar, on the Mizbeach, and is burned entirely. No one eats anything from it. It all goes to God. That's when you see the word Olah in the Torah in the context of a gift for God, that's what Olah means. The reason I did not translate it that way here is simply because Yitzchak is not an Olah. He is brought up on the altar, but he is not sacrificed. So therefore I took it in the more literal sense of Olah, that which goes up. So he says, bring Yitzchak, bring your son, as an ascendant offering, al achad heharim asher omar elecha, upon one of the mountains, which I will identify for you. Vayashkem Avraham bavoker, Avraham got up in the morning, he got up early in the morning, vayachavosh es hamoro, he saddled his donkey, vayikach es shnei ne'aravito, he took his two servants with him, ve'es Yitzchak beno, and he took his son Yitzchak. Vayivaka atzei ola, he cut wood for this ola, for this offering. Vayakam vayilech el hamakom asher amar lohu elokim, and he got up and went to the place that God had told him about. Sentence 4. Vayom ha-shalishi, on the third day, vayisa Avraham et eina vayaret hamakom merachok, Avraham picked up his eyes, he saw the place from afar, and then sentence 5, vayomer Avraham el me'arav, Avraham said to his youths, to these servants, shvulachem po im ha-chamor, sit here now, or sit for yourselves here with the donkey, v'ani v'hanar nilcha adko, I and the young man, the youth, will go to this place, we will bow, and we will return to you. I don't know about you, but I have a whole host of questions here on these sentences. Questions in terms of storyline, like what is happening here in the story, and questions in terms of the text. And what we're going to see is that the Medrash is bothered by many of these questions, which we are going to ask, and attempts to answer them. So let me throw it open first. What questions might trouble us in terms of the storyline that we've read? Not the overall, why is Avraham sacrificing his son? Not to the question of, if God doesn't like human sacrifice, why did he make Avraham go through this? Those are great questions. But I want questions about the story as outlined in the sentences that we have over here.
Well, there's one question. It says, well, God says, like, the place I will identify for you. And then he went to the place which God had identified for him. And then it says, on the third day, he raised his eyes and saw the place from afar. So why isn't he there? Why is he seeing the place from afar 3 days later?
Right. So I think the first part of that, when it says, because you're right, at first he says, the place I'm going to identify for you. And then it says, he went to the place God had identified. And on the third day, he saw it from afar. So is he there or isn't he there? Right. That's what you're asking. So I think in terms of the second passage that you quote, the end of sentence three, he went to the place which God had identified for him, I think is sort of he's going towards that place. He's not there yet. He's going towards it. Because the Hebrew is El HaMakom. You could render that as towards it, and that's why he's not there yet. But on that point, I think there's something fundamental in the storyline. Right? What's, how does Avraham know that he got there? What do you mean, on the third day, Avraham raised his eyes and he saw the place from afar? How does he know he's there? Right? It's only the place I'm going to identify for you. We're not told about any second announcement from God. The first time around, it's explicit in the Torah. God tells him exactly what's going on. Why now is it left as Avraham got to the place that God had identified? You're laying right here. I don't really need another chair over there. So that's one question.
Well, yeah. The third pasuk is said by the implication is somewhere along the way God told him, because otherwise it implies that God told him something. So then he must have said it's there, or that's described, and then when he saw it, then he recognized it.
Right. Right. Again, unless you just say he went towards the place because he knew mountains.
Yeah.
Right. If you take to the place and you take that as towards the place, right? It's troubling either way. I don't think that reading really solves the problem either. Not to mention the general question of why can't God just tell him? What's the big deal about just saying over there? That's where I want you to go. And we can give all sorts of answers for it. The Medrash that we're going to see isn't actually going to address that, if I remember correctly. But we may see something that leads us towards an answer on that. Other questions about the storyline?
I'm wondering why he left, if the donkey and the Narim were to take this stuff, why do you leave them far away? What's the whole point of it?
Yeah, well, let me start with the first question of why are they there?
Why are they there?
Right? He has these two youths. The image of a youth, as a general theme in the Torah, is someone who's there to serve. Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, is called a Nar. That's his job, is to schlep, basically. But look at what happened. In sentence three, Abraham saddled the donkey himself. He took the two youths, but then he cut the wood himself, right? And then he says to the youths, you stay here, right? Well, we're going to go the rest of the way. So, what are they doing? Why are they here in this story? Why are they there in the first place, and why are they not there at the end? Not only that, look at what Abraham says to them. What does he tell them is going to happen? Yeah, we're going to bow, and then we're coming home. Yitzchak's not coming home, as far as Avraham knows, right? It's not just a bowing thing, especially if we view Avraham, and we generally do, as someone who's trying to display his service of God to the world. Now, his only witnesses are actually staying back, and he's not telling them what he's about to do. Something else has to be going on here, that Avraham is not cluing them in on what's going to happen on the mountain.
I have a question about the terminology. In the English it says, sit yourselves here with the donkey, and the youth and I will go to this place. But it's not the youth he's taking to this place, it's his son.
Right, but he calls him youth. In other words, if you look in the Hebrew, va'ani ve'ana'ar, now he calls his son Einar. There's some debate as to exactly how old Yitzchak is at this point, but I was thinking about it as I read it. You're right. The Torah now, or Avraham now, is calling him a na'ar, as opposed to saying v'ani u'bni, my son and I. That's interesting. I hadn't planned on addressing it. I think it's a good question. Why does Avraham suddenly call him this by this other term? Maybe now because he has to be the schlepper, because now the two of them are stuck back with the donkey. In terms of the text, though, in terms of the language, I also find things that are strange. Why mention that this was the third day? Abraham has taken all sorts of trips, right? There was Lach Lecha, Abraham and Sarah's original journey to the land. We don't know what day it was when they showed up. There was their descent to Egypt, and then their return back up from Egypt. We don't get any news about how long they spent. Here, it's on the third day, suddenly there's something special here that I need to know, that it was a three-day journey. That's one. Number two, look at, and here the Hebrew is very helpful, that last sentence, when Abraham speaks to them, speaks to the youths, he says to them, you wait here with the donkey, and the youth and I are going to go ad ko.
Sham.
Right. Sham is there. Ko is here. Right? So why does he say, the youth and I will go to, I mean, the best I could do with it in the English, you see what I did in translating it, we'll go to this place. Maybe you could sort of render it as this place, but sham is the right word. Why does it say ko? Not to mention, why does the Torah go out of its way to tell us all about what's happening with these youths? Yeah, it's not as though when Eliezer goes with all the camels and everything and all his servants, it's not as though the Torah emphasizes what's going on with this, with his people the whole way on the journey to Laban. Why do we know this? There's a lot here in this set of psukim, of sentences. And the Medrash is bothered by a lot of what bothers us. Take a look, please, at source number 3. We're going to break down this Medrash, as you can see on your sheet, into three different parts. Here's the first part. Bayom HaShalishi, on the third day, Vayisa Abraham Medeinav, Abraham raised his eyes. Ksiv, the Pasuk says, Yechayenu miyomayim bayom hashalishi yikimenu v'nechye lefanav. A pasuk from Hosea, in which we are told, He, God, will revitalize us from 2 days. On the third day He will raise us up and we will live. A passage which, of course, gets much traction among the Christians, right? The idea of rising on the third day, being brought back to life, I mean, it's not a mystery. They had the sentences in front of them when they created their lore. I mean, it's not like the puzzle came afterwards, and you could say, oh my. Or awareness of the pasuk. But this pasuk here is quoted in reference to ours, when we are told on the third day he will raise us up and we will live. And here the Medrash launches into a list of occasions in the Torah in which there's a 2 day wait and then something happens on the third day. Bayom HaShlishi Shel Shevatim, the third day of the tribes of Israel, meaning Yosef's brothers. Ksiv, the Torah says, Bayomer Aleihem Yosef, Bayom HaShlishi. It's when the brothers go to Yosef for food and they are held for 3 days, and on the third day he says, this is what I'm going to do for you, and so on. Now he's ready to give them food. Bayom HaShlishi Shel Meraglim, on the third day of the spies. Shenamar v'nach beisem shama shloshes yamim. This is not the original infamous set of spies. These are the two spies Yehoshua sends into the city of Jericho, of Jericho, to decide how to invade and to hear about the state of mind of the people of Jericho. So they get found out. The king of Jericho discovers that they're there, and they have to hide, and they hide for 3 days before they are free to go home. Bayom HaShlishi Shel Matan Torah, the third day of the giving of the Torah. Shenamar, as the pasuk says, Vayihi Bayom HaShlishi. Right? They prepare for 3 days at Har Sinai. then they get the Torah. Bayom HaShalishi Shel Yonah, the third day of Yonah in the fish. Dechsid Bayi Yonah Bimei Hadagash Shlosha Yamim Ushlosha Leilos. He's there for 3 days and 3 nights before he gets spat out. Bayom HaShalishi Shel Oleh Gola, the third day of the Jews who came back from Babylonian exile to build the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple. Dechsiv, as the Pasuk says, Vaneshiv Sham Yamim Shalosha, we sat there for 3 days. Bayom HaShalishi Shel Tchiyas HaMeisim, and then they go back to the sentence that was quoted from Hosea, which we take to refer to Tchiyas HaMeisim, the ultimate resurrection of the dead. Dichsiv, as the Pasuk says, Yechayenu Miyomayim, Bayom HaShalishi Yekimenu B'nechya, he will revitalize us after 2 days, on the third day he will raise us up. And then the last one, Bayom HaShalishi Shel Esther, Bayihi Bayom HaShalishi Vatilbash Esther Malchus, and it was on the third day, Esther wore her royalty, her majesty, and went to King Ahasuerus to plead for the survival of the Jews, or to ask him to a party, which would eventually lead to her pleading for the survival of the Jews. Fine. The Medrash here presents us with a list of times in the Torah when there are 3 day periods. Okay. Why?
Yeah. At least not the most obvious one with Abraham after Shmila, since God came to
visit him. Does it say it's the third day?
Yes. So, I mean, that would be the most.
I think his question is that actually Lusha in the Chumash? Because these are all quotes.
I don't think it does. Rashi says it. Right, Rashi says that was the third day because that's the most painful day. I'm fairly certain it doesn't. It would be a good idea, though. Where you do have a third day is the people of Sodom. Of Shechem. People of Shechem, right? When it says by Hi Bayom HaShalishi BeYosam Kavavim. Maybe, yeah. Well, the idea of the third day being the most painful actually comes up in a few places, but the as a matter of fact, one of the most interesting ones, just to mention it, just because you brought it up, is there are various reasons given for why we use spices at Havdalah to make us feel better. Well, is it just from the departure of Shabbos? So one explanation that's brought is actually it's to make men feel better because it's the third day after the surgery from which Chava was produced. Because he's produced on the first Friday, and therefore 3 days later, now it's going to be after Shabbos. I thought that was interesting. But in any case, we're missing the Shechem list of 3 days. Frankly, there are other cases where there are 3 days that are not included here. But what in the world is this Medrash doing by bringing this list?
It seems to me that the ones that are brought here, and it's funny because the ones that were mentioned at the table don't quite fit as well, in my mind, is an idea of preparation. That in each of these cases there's a preparation that the person or Hashem feels is necessary.
Is that true for all of them? I see preparation, for example, in the presentation of the Torah. Right?
Presentation of the Torah, Esther, for some reason that she felt that there was preparation, Hashem decided that Yonah needed that preparation. You could almost look at each one of them, and there's something that happens. There's a readiness that seems to happen after on the third day.
In Yonah's case, he's there for 3 days, and then he sings his song to God and does tshuva. He repents. So maybe he's preparing to repent. Could be. But I don't know what to do with the 3 days. I don't see preparation in the hiding of the spies before they are able to escape from the king of Jericho. I don't see preparation in the revitalization of the dead. They're not doing anything. They're
maybe for some reason, like Hashem feels, in other words, that there's something about the third day that prepares these two.
Maybe. I'm looking for something that I think emerges from each of them. I could be wrong about what I'm thinking, but we'll have to see. What can we identify a common denominator?
3 days.
Got it. Next.
There was a change.
Just that something
sorry, there's also a change from something that...
Because were you in mid-sentence, or...
What?
I don't want to...
Did I interrupt you?
No.
Okay.
I'm just noticing that the third day is something positive coming out of some negative or some fear, or like those 2 days of preparation, they're not in a good space, and on the third day something wonderful happens. Or...
Right. So in terms of a change first, let's look at it. Yosef tells them, okay, now you're getting food and you'll be safe and so on. The spies are safe. The presentation of the Torah is certainly a change. Yonah gets out of the fish, that, you know, check. Ezra also. The resurrection of the dead, and Esther going to the king. These are changes. These are positive changes. There's an element of redemption that's going on here. To me, and I think this is similar to what you're saying, it's a wait for spiritual or physical salvation. And yes, a change in the person, himself, herself, preparing for some event or change that is to take place. And here, take a look, please, at source number 4. This is from a writer by the name of Jeffrey Rubinstein, and he's writing regarding Purim. And he quotes the work of Victor Turner, talking about what Turner terms a liminal state. Rubinstein applies it to what we do in our Purim celebrations, and you'll see why, I think, as you read the description here. Normally, social structure is hierarchical and characterized by differences in status, while social relationships are mediated by power and statute. Right? That's, I think, fairly straightforward. You live in a society which has a certain structure to it in terms of where people fit. And you have laws that govern how they relate to each other, or simply power governs the way they relate to each other. At certain times, however, the web of normal social relationships, the structural elements, appear to dissolve. Society enters what Victor Turner calls a liminal time, a betwixt and between, or threshold period. No longer do power and privilege, status and role, law and institution determine social interrelatedness. Society enters a, quote, time outside of time, where alternative modalities of social relatedness appear. In other words, all the old relationships break down, and people suddenly interact in brand new ways for this period of time, this moment. In some cases, a total status inversion occurs. During ritually defined times, such as the initiation of a king or a seasonal festival, the entire society may enter an overarching liminal mode when statuses, roles, and power relationships are reversed. Similarly, religious structures may be reversed. That which is taboo and prohibited becomes permitted or obligatory. The profane and the sacred invert. Rituals of status reversal remind society of the excesses perpetrated by those normally in positions of power over their inferiors. Yet they also reaffirm the usual social structure when the period of liminality ends and the normal structure sets in again. By temporarily playing the ordinary is strengthened. What he's getting at, in terms of general society, is the idea that there are festivals that go on in various cultures where suddenly the wealthy are treated as the indigent, and the indigent are elevated to great heights, and they get to play at being king. And that goes for a period of time, sort of reminding people that all these structures only exist as long as society entertains them, and therefore maybe some of the people who are in power should not be so brutal, because you never know when things are going to get reversed. And then it goes back to normal, reverting to the normal order of things. You can see, I think, the context in terms of celebration of Purim, why, you know, what he brings this for, the idea of wearing masks, the nahapochu, everything is reversed, the classic idea that is discussed in various Jewish legal writings, men being allowed to dress up as women during Purim celebrations, a mockery of the powerful, and how they would have a spiel and a grommet, or whatever term you throw on it, in which they would actually mock those who were normally in authority. All of these are parts of standard classic Purim celebrations, which he views as the sort of liminal state, which comes about at a time when the Jews almost were destroyed. Leaving aside the Purim Association, because that's its own class, really, I see the 3-day period as this sort of liminal state, not in the sense that he describes of a full overthrowing of the norm, but in the sense of a suspended state where the old rules are void. You're now in this sort of limbo, and then you emerge with certain goals achieved on the other side. It's a state where, if you look at our examples, the brothers, who are used to being the powerful, are now locked in prison to wait. You know, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to us next? The spies who are part of this conquering Jewish nation are suddenly cowering before the forces of Yericho, afraid that they're going to get caught. The Jews are told during these three-day period to prepare for our Sinai, to prepare for the giving of the Torah, that the husbands and wives separate. They're not living their normal family existence. Yonah's in a fish. What more can I say? There's this idea of being in a limbo state which is not the norm, and then there's a big transition that goes on at the end. It's something that I particularly like here. Whether you accept the liminal idea or not, it's clear that there is a three-day period of waiting before things are going to become different. And the fact that Abraham and Yitzchak go on this trip for a three-day period, bring this back to the Akedah, may be because there is a change going on. They have to become different on the way to the site that God is going to identify for them. And it didn't happen in the Lech Lecha trip. When Abraham and Sarah first went to Israel, to what was then called Canaan, there was no three-day journey. Maybe it was too early in their process of growth. When they went down to Egypt, when they came back from Egypt, you didn't have it. Now you have it. It doesn't have to be 3 days. Different periods of time may be needed for different changes. I think I brought it on your sheet in source number 5. We're told about Moshe waiting before he can go up to Sinai, waiting in a cloud for 6 days. And he has to wait for 6 days, we're told, so that he could become like the Malachim, like the angels, and ready to receive the Torah. That's a transition if there's ever been one. It's not 3 days. Maybe it's double 3 days. It's 6 days, even better. But the point to me is that the journey itself that they are making is a journey of change. It's not, you're now at home. I'm telling you, Abraham, bring your son as a sacrifice. And really, you could have done this next door. You know, and I didn't want it to be next door because, well, the mountain I wanted happened to be 3 days away. God chooses a spot that is 3 days away because he wants them to go through a change. He wants them to become different over that three-day period. Which may also be the... I'm trying to remember if I actually put this in my notes because I prepared this a week ago. I'm not sure it's occurring to me now or if I knew this all along. It could be that that's why God, it is in my notes later on, but I'm going to say it now. It could be that's why God doesn't tell him at the start where the location is. In other words, you're not ready yet, Abraham. When you are ready, I will tell you about, I'll tell you where this is going to be. Then I'll pick the spot. In the same way that the Jews who are in the desert are told, one day there's going to be a place God is going to choose, and that's where you're going to have a Beis HaMikdash, and you'll say, why doesn't God just say where it is? The answer is they're not ready yet. There's a journey they have to take first. So that's what's supposed to happen in this three-day trip. Yes?
Isn't there also a Kabbalistic significance to the number 3?
Well, there's a Kabbalistic significance to every number. Right? I mean, if it had been a 7-day trip, we for sure could have done a whole lot with it. But you're right. I mean, we do. We see significance in numbers in general. And, 3, we talk about the line from Kohelet, how a cord made of 3 threads will not break easily, and we connect that idea to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and the idea that when you have 3 generations in a row that are engaged in Torah, then they'll always be, all their descendants will be involved in Torah. We certainly have the idea of 3 as something significant. Yeah.
So, I'm struggling with understanding, because we see Abraham change so much over, through many of the Nisyonos that we hear about in the Torah, some of them that we only hear about in the Medrash. Is it do you think it's because this is his final nisayam that the 3 days have to be davka in this one? Because that's when it's Avraham, where he reaches his potential.
See, I'm not convinced that we see Avraham change. We see Avraham go through a lot, without a doubt. I mean, he's war, famine, you name it, Avraham does it. I'm not sure we see change other than in this story.
What change do we see in this story?
In this story, you have Avraham, who is known as the entity of, the representative of chesed, of giving, of generosity throughout the Torah. The one with the tent, he sits outside waiting. Maybe there will be guests. He goes to save Lot from Sodom. He prays on behalf of the people of Sodom. He's forever giving and trying to help others. And now he's taking a journey to sacrifice his son. I mean, Ramban talks about this, how that's the ultimate test, because you're telling somebody who has perfected a trait, now go turn it on its head for God. Yeah, take everything you've ever lived for and represented and throw it out the window. That is change to me. I don't know that Avraham... I think about Avraham in contrast to Moshe, where with Moshe we see different reactions in different situations, and that looks like somebody changing. I'm not sure that we've seen a change until now.
With Avraham, what we see is him is like Lech Lecha Vayelech Avraham, and we see it in every test, and even in this one, we see it. There's a little. You could say that there's a little of that when he kicks Yishmael out. That wasn't easy on him.
Right. That's
you know,
true.
He argued it, and he did, but he did it. You
right.
know, when Hashem
right.
said, "Listen, you know, Vayelech Avraham." It's like I see Avraham as very steadfast in doing whatever Hashem asks of him. As irrational as it seems, and as almost cruel, because it's true.
Obedience for Avraham trumps self.
Right.
You're right. The Yishmael case is another example of it, where his obedience trumps his self, because the idea of kicking out Yishmael also is very out of character.
It wasn't painful.
Right. That's true. Although I should note, the Medrash finds it so painful that they find hints that Avraham actually doesn't sever ties with Yishmael, that he goes after him afterwards and tries to bring him back, and Yishmael does come back in the end. This is irrevocable. If he goes through with this, there is no second chance. But I hear what you're saying. So the takeaway I get from this part of the Medrash, this part one, is the message of the journey as transition. The journey itself being valuable. And for the Jew in the month of Elul, working towards Rosh Hashanah, it's not simply there's going to be a day of judgment and I want to get ready for it. The getting ready for Rosh Hashanah in and of itself is valuable. The experience of thinking through what happened this past year, regretting the wrongs, trying to right the wrongs, trying to figure out what we did that we should be replicating. This is a trip of great value in and of itself. 30 days instead of 3, but that to me is what part one is saying. Let's take a look at the second part, please. The second part is a tangent. Midrashim love tangents, so this is a tangent, and it's built on the sentence regarding Esther. The end of part one brought us on the third day of Esther, and it was on the third day Esther clothed herself in majesty. So this jumps off from that and says in source number 6, Lavsha Malchus Beis Aviyah. She clothed herself in the monarchy of her family. Be'ezez chus. Via what merit, the Medrash asks. We're going to come back to that clause in a couple of minutes. Rabbanan v'Rabbi Levi. The sages debated with Rabbi Levi what the merit was that Esther used. Rabbanan Amri, the sages said, Bizchus yom hashalishi shalmatan Torah. It was the merit of the third day of the presentation of the Torah. That on a third day the Torah was given, now on a third day she went to Achashverosh. Shenamar, as the Pasuk says, Vayi bayom hashalishi, it was on the third day, V'yos havokir, in the morning. Rabbi Levi Amar, Rabbi Levi said, Bizchus shel yom shlishi shel Avraham Avinu, it was in the merit of the third day of Avraham, Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Bayom HaShlishi, on the third day, just like Avraham and Yitzchak reached the mountain on the third day, so too Esther goes to Ahasuerus on the third day, and we know how the story continues, that Ahasuerus, she finds favor in Ahasuerus' eyes and manages to win the day. What is bothering this Medrash? Why does this Medrash feel the need to do this? It's an interesting analogy, or not analogies. It's an interesting linkage of different events that I understand. But what's it doing here? It's not a simple one. So, to my mind, the Medrash here, first of all, keep in mind something that we saw before the summer when we did our Medrash series, which is the compilers of Medrash brought together Medrash on various passages from all over Tanakh, even with tenuous links. They brought them together into the same text. So that what we are seeing here, this middle section of this Medrash, actually probably originated as part of Medrash on the Book of Esther. But it got grafted in because it fit a Medrash about three-day things. So that's why it ends up here. So don't look for it to be a linear flow from A to B to C. But what I think this Medrash is bothered by is the statement Vatilbash Esther Malchus, that Esther wore majesty. Because, number one, what does it mean to wear majesty? So clearly, in context, we understand it means she put on her royal clothing, right? I would expect that that's what it would mean. But even that is problematic, because Esther is the queen. She wears royal clothing all the time. Didn't she give that message to Mordechai when Mordechai is wearing rags at the entrance and she says, you can't do that here, right? If you want to be in the palace compound, you have to dress nicely. So you could say now she wore especially good clothing. Now she wore real finery. Maybe it was from the day that she was crowned as queen. She wore the original dress that she wore that day. You can give answers, meaning we don't need this Medrash in that sense. It's not that I can't understand the sentence in the Megillah without it, but the Medrash jumps on that and says, Malchus, her majesty, was not simply about her clothing. 3 days signifies a significant transition. Some transition must have taken place besides a change of clothing. She fasted, she prayed. Something else happened besides she got finery. You know, she went to the closet and found something that looked really, really attractive. The more is going on here. And what is it? It's a special merit. And what is the special merit that she has? Two possibilities. Either the merit of the presentation of the Torah, or the merit of the Akedah, the offering up of Yitzchak. Not done with that, though. Because why pick these three? These two. These two threes, so to speak. Right, if we had a list, why couldn't it have been the third day of the tribes? Why couldn't it have been the third day of, I don't know, Yonah? I don't know. The merit of Yonah's 3 days in the fish. Well, that hadn't happened yet. The Ezra one. Remember, the events of Esther happened in the interlude between the first and second temple. So Ezra's hasn't happened. But what I see here actually reminds me of I'm cribbing off of my son. My son's bar mitzvah's bar Torah. In Parashas Balak, we're told that Balak wants to curse the Jews. He wants Bilam to do it, and Bilam needs to gain divine favor in order to do that. And so, he hires Bilam. We know the story. Bilam says he wants to curse the Jews. God says it's not going to work. Bilam goes anyway. And when Bilam shows up, he says, okay, this is what you have to do. Build 7 altars. And so he builds 7 altars, and he comes back to Bilam and says, I have built the 7 altars. He says, great. tries to curse them, it doesn't succeed, tries a second time, and again he says, build seven altars. He builds seven altars, doesn't succeed, tries a third time, build seven altars. He builds seven altars, doesn't succeed, and then afterwards Bilam says, guess it's just not going to work, let me tell you some other things instead. And that takes us to the end of the parsha. But why seven altars each time? What's this constant refrain of Shivat HaMizbechot, of the seven altars? So take a look at source number seven, please. Rashi's explanation. Shiva Mizbechos Arachti Ein Ksiv Kan. When Balak reports, King Balak reports into the prophet Bilam saying, I built seven altars for you. He doesn't say, I arranged seven altars. Ela et shivat hamizbechot. He says, the seven altars, as though there's something unique and special about seven. Amar Lefanav, he said to him, this is Bilam speaking to Balak, Avoseim shal elu banu lefayach shiva mizbechos, v'ani arachti keneged kulan. The ancestors of the Jews built seven altars. I have now arranged their equal. Meaning, if you count up the altars the Torah lists Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov building, the tally is seven. So I'm going to build seven just like they had seven. That's one explanation. Second explanation in source number eight, from the Baal HaTurim, Rabbeinu Yaakov Baal HaTurim, writing in the 13th century, maybe 14th. Kein minhag b'nei Noach. This is the custom of Noachites, meaning people who are not Jewish. La'akriv shiva shiva keneged sheva mitzvot shalohem. They bring sets of seven because they have seven mitzvot, the seven Noachide commandments. So Baal HaTurim's approach is seven because they have seven mitzvot. So my son explained in his Dvar Torah that these are really two different approaches. One approach is to throw yourself on the merit of your ancestors. My ancestors built seven altars. And Bilam now is going to replicate that. He's going to have seven altars just like it. But one approach of the Jew is to say, I may not be great, but my ancestors, they were great, and in their merit, please God, answer me. The other approach is, we have mitzvot. The mitzvot that we engage in, that come from the Torah to us. Or for the non-Jews, they have their Noahide laws. It's not about what my ancestors did, it's about what I do now. Seven mitzvot, seven altars. Two different possibilities. So I see the same split in this medrash about Esther's merit. One view is that Esther comes in on the third day, like the third day of the presentation of the Torah. That's her own merit, because she is an heir to the Torah. She practices the Torah. The other approach is, Abraham did this on the third day, therefore I'm going in on the third day. It's about the merit of her ancestors. So that's what I see in this second piece of the Medrash. It's that the majesty of Esther, the majesty of the Jew, comes from these two sources, our ancestors and ourselves. And to me, that's another relevant piece for Rosh Hashanah, that we have these two elements on which we can draw when we approach God on the Day of Judgment. So we have seen two parts so far.
Bilam didn't have ancestor merit. He was
correct.
Going against the merit of the ancestor. So why did he build eight? So he'd have more merit.
So he'd have more than they did. Right, he's matching them. They did seven, I do seven. We find similar ideas, actually Purim related also. When Haman brings the 10,000 kikar of silver, and the Gemara says he's bringing 10,000 because when you look at the silver that the Jews used in building the Mishkan, you had 10,000 kikar of silver. So why didn't you do 10,001? They could have had one more than them. It's the idea of matching. If it had been 10,001, we would have said, see, he wanted to exceed by one. But that's the best I can do with it. I see then two lessons so far from this Midrash. Number one, the power of the journey. That's the time of transition. And number two, that we come in with our merit and the merit of our ancestors. Let's look at the last part of this Midrash now. Source number nine.
Sorry, I just want to think, if you read in the Hebrew in number six, Lashama Beit Aviha, it brings in the past. It talks about, wearing, like if you translate it, the monarchy of her family.
Right.
That's that as well.
Right.
That's her ancestry.
That's true also. It's her ancestry, right.
But it doesn't have to be.
Besabiha could be her ancestry. It could also be Besabiha, in other words, our family, our religion.
But that's also Malthus.
Right.
Right.
Right. Well, that's the two things, exactly.
But that's it's also, like you say, the transition, but also the family. Like that to me gives it a little more weight.
Yeah. Right, the use of the phrase Beit Aviha. It's a good point. If I ever teach this again, I don't have it. Good.
Well, I just kind of...
No, it's true.
When you were speaking.
It's true. The third part here. Vayaris hamakom mirachok. Avram saw the place from far away. So clearly this Midrash is bothered by what bothered us when we first read those psukim. What did he see? How does he know that this is the place? He saw the place from afar. Ma ra'a, what did he see? Ra'anan kashur bahar. He saw a cloud tied to the mountain. Omar, he said, Dome sha'oza makom sha'amar li HaKadosh Baruch Hu la'akriv es bini sham. It seems to me that the place to which, the place where that God said to me, oh, that's where you're bringing your son, that's it over there. The place of which God told me, I did my best to render this into English grammar in the translation. It's uniquely Hebrew grammar. It appears this is the place of which God told me to sacrifice my son there. Amar li Yitzchak. So he turns to Yitzchak and he says, Bini, my son, Ro'eh ata masha ani ro'eh. Do you see what I see? Mind you, he doesn't tell him what he's seeing, but do you see what I see? Amar li Hein. Yeah. Amar l'shnei ne'arav, he said to his two youths, Rohim atem masha ani roed, do you see what I see? Amru lo lav, they said no. Amar, he said, Ha'ol v'chamor eino roed, v'atem ein atem rohim, he said the donkey doesn't see. He didn't ask the donkey. We're leaving the Bilam story aside. He says the donkey didn't see, and you didn't see. Shvulachem ba machamor, so you stay here with the donkey. That's this Midrash. So what questions is this Midrash trying to answer?
Why he left them?
Well, first of all, right? Why did the departure of the youths, right?
How he knew it was the place,
right? Also, what else is within the let me go in order. The special character of the place is being addressed here. Now we know what it was that Avraham saw. We also know something else. If you look back at the psukim in source number 1, at the sentences themselves, it said, "Vayisa Avraham es einav." Avraham raised his eyes and he saw the place. Now I understand that it's Avraham who sees it because Avraham is spiritually suited to do so. The youth don't see it at any point. It also explains what the ko is in the sentence. We wanted to know, why does he say nelcha ad ko instead of nelcha ad sham? Because he's pointing, right? He's pointing and he's saying, we're going to go to this, to these clouds that are there atop the mountain. Ko is a term that we use when you point to something and say, that's what I'm talking about. There's more to say on that with the word ko, but we'll leave that for now. So that's one piece that the Midrash is addressing, is the special character of the place. The commentators on this debate what Avram actually saw. Was it an unusual cloud close to the mountain? Was it Hashem's glory somehow manifest on the mountain? But the other piece of it is the departure of the youths. Because I wanted to know why Avraham took the youths with him in the first place, and if he brought them, why he now told them to wait. What happened? What's the answer?
The answer to the second part, not to the first part.
The answer to both parts.
Really?
Yeah, we can now answer what they were doing there in the first place.
That they were spiritually on the level to accept it, and then he realized they weren't.
Bingo. Yeah, Avraham thought that they would achieve it, especially when you look in the Midrash when it asks, who are these youths? Eliezer and Yishmael. Parenthetically, just because you asked about Yishmael getting kicked out, this is after Yishmael was kicked out. Yishmael's already home. According to the Midrash, this is Yishmael. He's already back. But the idea of it is Avraham thinks that they are going to go, that they're going to be witnesses and participate in this. And he asks them, do you see? And they say no, and he realizes this isn't for them. Which is why the Torah goes out of its way to tell us about their fate, to say, not everyone was suited for this. This was something unique. And also to tell us, that, I'm sorry, and also we now understand why Abraham doesn't tell them what's going to happen. From the fact that they don't see it, that's a sign to Abraham, they don't belong in this. This isn't for them. And so he doesn't tell them what's going to happen. Mind you, I'm still stuck on the fact that he told them, we will return. I mean, in practice, only Abraham comes down the mountain. Even though Yitzchak is alive, we're told only Abraham came down. And the Medrash fills in that Yitzchak went to go study. But what did happen when they saw that only Abraham was there? We know the Medrash about Sarah thinking that Yitzchak is dead and that leading to her death. But the point here within the context of this Medrash is the Medrash is answering a whole bunch of our questions by introducing this point. There's something there that Abraham sees. They don't see it. Abraham and Yitzchak both see it. They've undergone a transition. The youths have not. And so at this point, they're left by the side. And what I see here, to take it back to the lessons for us, number one, this is where it comes in, what I jumped the gun on before, that the knowing you have reached the goal can only come after you have made the journey. Abraham can't know the goal. He can't know which mountain it is, so to speak, until after he has made the trip. He has to do that transition, and those who never make the transition are never going to know. And so they remain there with the donkey. The Medrash actually continues. I cut it short, but Elaine can see it in her edition. The Medrash continues to be rather derogatory to the Ne'arim, to the youth. It didn't add to the point here, so I didn't bring it. That's number one. And for us, then, in Elul, it's true as well. At the start of our tshuva process, when we begin reviewing what's happened over the course of the year, we don't know what it's going to take. We don't know what we're going to encounter within ourselves and what it's going to take to root out that which we need to root out. But once we've grown and changed and evolved, we're going to know it. We'll see, so to speak, the cloud atop the mountain that signifies that we've made it there. That's the hopeful idea. So I see in this Medrash, just to close it, three big lessons for us. Lesson number one, the value of the journey. Lesson number two, the two pieces of merit that we have, our ancestors and our own deeds. And number three, that having done the journey, once we've done it, then we'll know that we've reached our goal. God willing, next week we'll do part two on the Akedah.
After Rosh Hashanah.